This is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 2nd, and this is show number 293. Well, Happy New Year, everybody. I hope you all had great holiday times. I hope you ate too much. I hope you drank too much. And I hope you didn't kill off any of your relatives, no matter how much they probably deserved it. Steve and I had a great time with our relatives and friends. And one thing I noticed, though, during the holidays, an awful lot of podcasters took a week or more off, either not doing shows at all, or doing reruns, and labeling them as best of shows. I was kind of proud that with your help, the NoSillaCast never missed a beat. All right, enough holiday cheer. Let's get this show on the road. So I must confess to the real audience here that the live audience has been enjoying the fact that Justin G. Byrne of the Mac Crack is actually in the house right now, in the studio where the magic happens, right, Steve? And what'd you say, Justin, about the Mac Crack? Did you guys, you work through the holidays, right?
Hell no, we take about a month off. And then we have a week on and then about another month off.
You know, your work ethic there, it's tough to keep up with.
Well, you know, sometimes you need a lot of recovery after a show like Mac Crack.
That's true. A little bit of Mac Crack goes a long way.
Especially if you're a listener.
All right, well, let's keep working here. Let's get this going here. Well, you've heard me say about 100 times that one of my favorite developers is Steve Harris of Reinvented Software. He wrote the application Feeder, which is possibly the most important software I use in creation of the podcast. I put him probably in my top five list because he's really responsive to all of my requests, even if I'm asking him for something that's already in the software and he has to find a polite way of saying, "Hey, moron, click here." Before I ever even used Feeder, I used his tool Together, which is a really nice digital notebook application. Now, I'm really excited today because Steve has gotten around to adding a third application to his suite called Poster. When I heard about Poster, I sent a note off to Steve and told him my one fear would be that I wouldn't be able to do a balanced review because I know him and I've really benefited from all the help he's given me over the years, and I was afraid, you know, maybe I'd be kind of biased. Here's what he wrote back. "Please don't spare my feelings because the world needs your kind of review. Well, hopefully not like some of the ones I've heard where you're foaming at the mouth, but an honest one at least." All right, Steve, gloves are off with a comment like that. It's time to tell you what problem Poster actually solves before we get into it, though. Poster is designed to make it easier to upload photos to Facebook and Flickr from iPhoto and Aperture. In the old days, this was a real pain. You had to export your photos to your disk and then upload them using the cruddy uploaders built into the websites. Or maybe there were some dodgy and kind of unreliable plugins you could use. But now, both iPhoto and Aperture have built-in capabilities to upload directly. After I walk through how Poster works, I'll look back and try to assess whether it's worth it to use Poster versus that built-in capability. When I first started up Poster, it asked me if I wanted to install the plugins for Aperture and iPhoto. And after I said yes, sure enough, under Export in Aperture, there was a choice for Poster. Before I tried uploading from Aperture, though, I wanted to see what Poster would do all on its own first. I figured the first thing I could do is set up the accounts I wanted to upload to, Facebook and Flickr. I opened Preferences, clicked on Accounts, and it looked like the right kind of window where, you know, there should be a plus in the bottom left to add new accounts. But oddly, there was no plus sign, only a grayed out minus sign. But then I decided maybe I should stop trying to be clever and just do what Poster was telling me to do right on screen. You see, the opening screen was a big blank area saying, "Drag photos here." Sure enough, dragging a photo onto the screen launched a window asking me to set up a new Facebook or Flickr account with Poster. I authorized Poster to access my Flickr account, and a beautiful window came up. It showed my uploaded photo in a pane on the left, and in the right sidebar, it showed all of the metadata that goes along with a photo on Flickr. I could change the name, enter a description, enter tags, select a set to add the photo to, put it in a group, change moderation settings like privacy, safety, content type, and accessibility to public searches. Rather than being utilitarian, though, the interface is what you've come to expect from great Mac software. Simple, yet elegant. Even the tags autofill from your tags you've used in the past. While the image goes up immediately on Flickr, after you fill in all the metadata on Poster, you have to hit Post to have it be effective. And then Poster shows you a nice copy of your image with an invitation to view it on your Flickr page. I sort of assumed that after I went to look at my mastery over on Flickr, I could flip back to Poster and mess around some more with the photo, adding more tags and such. But when I went back to Poster, it was blank again, awaiting more photos. I guess that makes sense, though, in the long run. It's not like Poster's job is to keep a view under your Flickr or Facebook account in order to edit from there. Okay, now that we've fallen in love with Poster straight up, let's have another look at the plugin again over in Aperture. This time I chose New Account again so I could test out uploading to Facebook. Aperture spun for a bit, like it's wont to do, and then it took me right into Poster again with the same option to set up a new account. Well, this is slick because I'm not learning another tool. It's just a command in Aperture that helps me get to Poster without dragging photos out of Aperture manually to the desktop first. When it came time to authorize Facebook, my blood pressure went up. Not because of anything to do with Poster, but Facebook settings. I hate how they put in there, you're authorizing this tool to do this long list of obvious things it would need to do, but hey, we're going to throw in one thing that makes no sense at all just to make you crazy. In this case, Facebook is telling me I'm authorizing Poster to access my basic information, post to my wall, access my photos, but also to access my data anytime, even when I'm not using the application. What the heck is that? I know, Bart, I can hear you now. Run away, run away. But of course I didn't. I checked with Steve, and he said that he had no control over that window and assured me that Poster would not be connecting into Facebook when it wasn't even running. Pretty dorky on Facebook's part, but everyone here who's not surprised, raise your hand. Now, with all these lovely things about Poster, the real question is whether the $20 purchase price is worth it versus using the built-in Flickr Facebook uploader options within Aperture and iPhoto. I ran the uploader to Flickr from Aperture and iPhoto, and I remembered why I want an app like Poster. The fields are really limited in what you can enter before the picture goes up to Flickr. Basically, all the built-in uploaders let you do is tell it what set to put it in, what size to make it, and who could see it. If you want to enter a description or tags, you have to do that in the web interface. That's not such a big deal if it's one photo, but when I have a whole pile of photos to upload, it drives me crazy in Facebook that my daughter always starts commenting before I even get a chance to entitle and tag the photos. I know that the Aperture built-in utility is supposed to allow you to tag the images, but it's pretty much crapola in my opinion. Very hard to use. Sorry, Justin, I didn't mean to offend your delicate sensibilities there with my language. So I went back to Poster to see if it did Facebook tagging. At first, I didn't see it, but then I saw a little person icon at the bottom of the upload window. When I clicked on it, sure enough, it let me start tagging my images. I suggested to Steve that he ought to have these little tooltip pop-ups that come when you hover over a tool. Nice to be given a hint instead of having to click on each button to see what they do. Poster is definitely talking to Facebook in a good way. As I started to type names, it auto-filled names from my friends list on Facebook. I tested tagging for Flickr, and it worked as well. I later put up nearly 100 photos to Facebook, all tagged before my daughter could get to them, and Poster worked like a champ. The only thing I'd improve here is that if you're tagging a photo and hit next photo, I think it should stay in the tagging mode. That is a personal preference, though. I did have a few windowing weirdnesses. Occasionally, Poster's window would jump to the background when I didn't ask it to, and command tabbing to the application would not bring it to the front. If I clicked it in the dock, it would bring it forward, so at least I had a workaround. I also found that Poster left square artifacts on screen if you clicked more than once to try to place a tag. So in Facebook, normally, if you click in the wrong place to put a tag, you just click again to put it in a new place. But with Poster, that's not exactly how you do it. You're supposed to click in one place. Let's say you misplace it. You just kind of drag it to the new location. That makes complete sense. But if you're used to Facebook tagging, that's not quite how it works. So like I said, I got these weird artifacts. I made Steve a short video using ScreenFlow so he could see exactly how I trigger the problem. And he was really excited that I did that because he was able to replicate it on his end to figure out how to fix it. I also found on occasion when I would hit next photo, the screen would just go black. It wasn't a missing photo. It wasn't a bad photo. It was just a weirdness. So if you just click next photo, it'll come up just fine. Bottom line time. Poster is a very pleasing tool. It has nice animations. It provides functionality that I do personally need. I'm looking forward to little bug fix upgrades on Poster. I told Steve you ought to add me to the beta test list because I can find these things. Anyway, with these little glitches I described in the interface, it would be nice to get an update, but I'm absolutely confident in Steve Harris as a developer that he will get these things fixed because he always does. Even before those artifacts get fixed, though, if you're a big old crazy Facebook or Flickr uploading fiend, that was hard to say, I almost said Flipper in the middle, Anyway, if you're a big old crazy Facebook Flickr uploading fiend and it drives you crazy that people comment on your photos before you get a chance to tag and name them, then I think Poster is worth the $20. I will definitely be using it. And since I wrote up this review, I've used it 4 or 5 times and I love it. On the other hand, if you occasionally drop a single photo onto one of these sites, you probably don't need Poster. You can use the built-in functionality for Aperture and iPhoto, and it'll work fine for you. Poster is Snow Leopard only, will run you $20, and is available at reinventedsoftware.com.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Sue Brady wrote in with this week's dumb question. Dear Allison, I've heard you mention on a recent podcast the lack of dumb questions for Dumb Question Corner. Do you think it's due to all the great education you're giving us in your podcast? I'm a regular listener and occasional attendee in the chat room for the live show. Generally, I prefer to try to figure out my own questions, but I did come up with one that I haven't had time to research and thought perhaps you'd know the answer. I've rented a movie from Amazon, and I want to view it by connecting my MacBook Pro to my TV. And speaking of Amazon, I've started with the search link on your webpage to do all of my Christmas shopping. Yay! Good job, Sue! Anyway, I've got my MacBook Pro all hooked up to the TV, and during the test, I discovered that if I close the lid of my MacBook Pro all the way, it goes to sleep and stops the movie. I don't want to watch two displays of the same movie. So is there a way to change that lid action so it doesn't go to sleep but the movie still plays? Or do you have a better solution or suggestion? The only solution I had was to put a towel over the MacBook Pro screen. Primitive, but it worked. Hey, don't knock primitive. Amazon doesn't have an app on the Apple TV like Netflix. And while I do have a Roku box, which does have Amazon connections, it's not connected to the TV that I want to watch this movie on. There has to be a simple solution I'm missing. Lastly, thanks for all the great content in your very entertaining podcast, and I'm staying subscribed. Well, Lisa, I just love it. Maybe the audience is just getting so much more knowledgeable over the years. That's awesome. Now, onto your problem. Turns out there's a trivially easy solution. I started out by searching for the problem, and when I came across the solution, it was one of those don't moments where you realize you knew the answer all along. I just didn't put all the pieces together properly. I'll give you the problem I have that should have instantly jumped to my brain when trying to solve yours. Every night, I plug my iPhone into my MacBook Pro to charge it. I have to be very careful with the order in which I do it, plugging it in before I close the lid. Otherwise, it wakes up my Mac and turns on my external monitor. See where I'm going with this? All you have to do is close the lid and then plug in any USB device. It'll wake up the Mac with the external monitor, the internal monitor off, and the TV should be on. You could also keep something plugged in, like a mouse, a keyboard, etc., and then simply click it with the lid closed, and the Mac will wake right up. Easy peasy. One word of caution is that the Mac may start to run really hot with the lid closed, so maybe you want to get one of those laptop cooling thingies. Even one of the passive ones like the Thermapack work very well to drop it maybe like 6 degrees Fahrenheit. You can get that at thermapack.com. That's thermapak.com. If you're heading off to Macworld in January, I hope you'll join me and Steve and most of the Mac Roundtable crew for a special Nosilla Castaways party on Friday night from 6 to 8 p.m. We're going to be over at Jillian's right across the street from Moscone in a nice private room. If you'd like to join us, RSVP by clicking on the button in the right sidebar over at podfeet.com. That'll give us a count of the people so we can make sure we have enough hors d'oeuvres for everyone. So I should mention this isn't a free drink thing, invite everyone, you know, wild, crazy party. This is for fans of the show. But if you're traveling with someone and you want them to come, feel free to register them as well. Now, I spent a bunch of time figuring out what plugin for WordPress to use for the Nosilla Castaways party, and I ended up with one called RS Events. It's capital R, capital S, capital E, and it ends in an exclamation point, which works pretty well. But it turns out it doesn't have a CAPTCHA, so I'm learning many new porn names through the spam registrations to the party. Steve heard me complaining about how much time I was spending deleting all the spam entries, and he offered to help keep it cleaned up. Well, that meant I had to teach him how to do it. I started by typing in an email, but after, I think it was the second line, I realized, oh, this is a job for ScreenSteps. It was so easy to go through the steps in WordPress, take screen snapshots on each step using screen steps. And I went back and annotated the screenshots with arrows and rectangles and sequence numbers, and I threw in some text to explain to Steve the why of each step. I clicked Export to HTML Clipboard, pasted that into the email to Steve. Now we'll see if I can get him to read his email and do all the work for me. Well, anyway, ScreenSteps Desktop is only $40, and with my coupon code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, it drops it down to $30. You really do need a January present for yourself, so head on over to ScreenSteps.com and check out the free 15-day trial. Speaking of Macworld, the famous OzRose is here with a question about connectivity while she's in the United States for Macworld.
G'day, girls and boys. My head is spinning, but in a really good way. Over the last couple of days, I've been finalising planes, trains and hotels for the Macworld adventure. Planes, check. Trains, check. Hotel San Fran, check. Hotels LA, check. San Diego Zoo ticket, check. Really looking forward to the San Diego Zoo. Figured on spending the whole day there. The San Diego hotel is proving somewhat more problematic, but will be sorted soon. I love my Twitter mates. Now to the ever-important connectivity issue. Oh, gosh, I love that word. Connectivity. Now, as we all know, international roaming costs are ridiculous, but I will switch them on and use my iPhone for texting only. Must be able to text Jenna and Geeta to get them out of bed for breakfast at the Samovar Tea Lounge, 7:30 a.m. every morning. That is not negotiable. And all NoCilla castaways are, of course, welcome to join us. But my sense of direction is so non-existent as to be physically dangerous. I have lots of little adventures planned for San Fran and Los Angeles and could take screen snaps of Google Maps at the hotel of an evening. But an affordable data plan for all-day connectivity would be best. Connectivity. My iPad is unlocked, but Jenna says 3G is woeful in San Fran. She suggests hiring a Wi-Fi thingy from Verizon. So, my lovely little NoCilla castaways, tell me what to do in words of 3 syllables or less, please. My head is spinning. See you soon, she says with a little shiver of excitement.
Okay, if anyone has advice for Rose, they can email her at rosematthews@mac.com. Now, I have one suggestion, Rose, and that's to go back and have a re-listen to Pat Mon's advice from last year when he explains how the MiFi 2372 helped him have reasonably priced internets on the go. He did that way back on show number 251, so I put a direct link in the show notes to that episode for you. He went through all of the options, the cost, and why he chose that particular MiFi over the other options. Good luck with figuring this out.
Hey there, Allison. It's Donald from the Talking About Podcast, here with a review of Alarms. If you're like me, throughout the day you'll have various time-related things that you have to keep track of. Let's say, call Dave at 2 o'clock to discuss the Christmas party, or don't forget to pick up the dry cleaning at 4, or be sure and watch that great news episode of insert name of popular TV show your friend was raving about, which starts at 8 o'clock. And if you're like me, you want to be reminded of these events. Because, after all, when geeks like us get on our computers, we're pretty much oblivious to the world. So some kind of reminder alarm would be ideal in situations like this. But firing up iCal or BusyCal or whatever to create one-time events like this is kind of silly. Enter Alarms by Stefan First. This program lives in your menu bar as a small icon. Click on it, and a panel swoops down from above, showing you a timeline of your day. All you have to do to schedule an event is double-click at the time you want the event to occur and type. But wait, there's more. If your event involves a file on your computer, like be sure and email the status report to Bill before you leave at 5 o'clock, just drag the file's icon on top of the alarms icon and the timeline will pop open, and then just drag the file onto whatever time you want it to remind you. This works for almost any type of draggable object, too. URLs from Safari, mail messages from mail.app, and so on. When the alarm's time arrives, the program will play a sound of your choice, and the alarm's icon begins to pulsate. Left-click the icon, and the timeline slides down, showing your event. At this point, you can either mark it as done or reschedule it by sliding it further down the timeline. If the event includes a file or some other object you dragged into it, you can then double-click on it to open that object. Or, if you need a few minutes, you can choose to snooze the alarm, in which case it'll bug you 5 minutes later. This snooze time is configurable as well. You can also schedule events days, weeks, or even months into the future, but I don't really see the point of this, since if you're going to do that, then you might as well just use iCal or BusyCal or whatever. The program is small and unobtrusive, and works really well. The only problem is that it requires OS 10.6 Snow Leopard, which leaves you PowerPC users out in the cold. Aside from that, however, the only negative thing I can find to say about it is that it takes up yet another slot in the long line of minibar icons on my monitor. But this is a minor complaint, and at $15, the program is really not that bad price-wise either. Find out more and download a free 14-day trial at alarmsapp.com. There is one more thing. Next weekend, January 7th through the 9th, the Anime Los Angeles convention will be held at the LAX Airport Marriott. This is a really small but fun event and is perfect for the new fan or fan-to-be to find out what all this anime stuff is about in a friendly, non-threatening environment. And guess what? I'll be speaking again. I'll be putting on the same two workshops I did last year. Anime Podcasting for Beginners is basically like Allison's Podcasting on Podcasting series of episodes, all compressed down into 1 hour. If you've ever wanted to know how to get started in this podcasting thing without spending a lot of money, but still getting decent quality, come see it on Saturday at 4 o'clock in Live Programming 3, Imperial A. And if you've ever taken pictures at anime conventions, or anywhere else for that matter, only to come home and find that you've ended up with a big old bag of hurt, then come see Convention Photography 101 Friday at 3 o'clock, again, in Live Programming 3, Imperial A. Hope to see you there, hope you enjoy the review, and I'll see you next time.
Hey, Donald, great review as always. You know, I went over to alarmsapp.com, and they have a teeny little video that shows off how simple this application is to use, and the video shows that they clearly have a great sense of humor. Anyway, thanks for the tip, and good luck on your two presentations. Well, after David Allen's endorsement of ArtText from BeLightSoft.com last week, I did end up buying the Mac Update bundle, so I have a few fun applications to review now. The first one I'd like to talk about is called Mac Family Tree from CiniumSoftware.com. Now, I'm not one of those people who's crazy about researching all of their relatives back a zillion levels, but I do find myself entertained from time to time just trying to name my cousins. There are a lot of them. My brother Grant and I play it as a game because we can't name them all. I think it might be fun for my kids to at least know our tree back to Steve and my grandparents, for example. As an All My Children fanatic, I've always wanted to see if I could document how many husbands Erica Kane has had. Maybe I could do that with Mac Family Tree. Okay, quick little break in the review here. Two things have happened. Number one, it's raining like crazy outside, so if you hear some noise in the background, that doesn't mean I forgot to turn the heater off. That's actually the rain outside. Anyway, back to Mac Family Tree. Now, as you listen to this review, keep in mind that I haven't used any Family Tree software before, so I cannot compare and contrast, and I also can't tell you whether this software would work for the genealogist zealot, only how well it works for someone wanting to document a few generations. When you first launch Mac Family Tree, you're asked to add a person. That made sense, so I just started in the middle by entering my dad's name, gender, and some person events. There are about a zillion person event options. I only entered birthday, but you can put in bar or bat mitzvah, christening, burial, circumcision. Really? Circumcision? Well,
that's too much personal information.
I think that got Justin's eyes up there. The only date I knew for my dad was his birth, so I filled that in. I have made a concerted effort never to note the date or even the year when someone dies, so I don't remember when my father died. I did make that decision right after I had a friend who had come to work all dressed in black and mope around the office all day once a year on the anniversary of her father's death. I can't imagine someone I loved really wanting me to do that, so I chose to never remember these dates at all. I had one problem where I accidentally added an extra spouse to my mother. Since she's only been married once, for over 50 years, by the way, to my father, I wanted to delete that extra person. However, when I deleted that fictitious spouse, my mother, and all of her children disappeared instantly. Turns out they're still there, but for some reason, they scare the pants off you by erasing the screen. There's a pane down the right-hand side where you can see all of the names in your tree and even search for them if you have a giant tree. When I clicked on my mom's name, the tree came right back. I think it would be a slight improvement to not erase the screen when a person's deleted, don't you? On a related note, editing relationships was pretty much not possible near as I could figure out. For example, I added one of Steve's cousins and accidentally made her a child rather than a sibling of her brother and sister. I could find no change relationship option. I tried dragging, I tried right-clicking, I looked at the menus, I even looked in the manual. I had to completely delete her and re-add her. If I'd entered a lot of information about her, that would have been really annoying. Like, what if I had all of her kids and her kids' kids and something like that? That'd be really annoying. Mac Family Tree has a plethora of options for how to visualize your family tree. You get everything from the fairly normal org chart-looking view to a virtual tree where your family members are spinning in 3D space. Not sure how that one really helps, but it sure is fun to flip the view around. Once you click on a person, you can switch between ancestor chart and descendant chart so you can look up or down their branch of the family. If you've been rigorous about birth and death dates, you can see your relatives on a timeline chart. That's actually handy to check your data input. I put mine in the timeline view, and I have this big clump of people on the far right end of the timeline and one lonely little person far over on the left. That's when I discovered that putting a birth year of 66 means literally 66, not 1966. I fixed that up, and I had a really pretty timeline to view. There are a few views I don't completely understand, like the statistics chart said I didn't have enough data to produce any charts. I had like, 50 people in my chart, but I didn't have a lot of data about each person, so maybe that was the deal. There were a lot of other views that I think you'd have to be really into the genealogy thing to understand. They looked neat, but I didn't know what they were trying to tell me. The Reports tab was a lot of fun. You can choose a person and instantly see everything about them. Partners, siblings, parents, children, in-laws, and all in a sort of spreadsheet view showing births and deaths and relationship. Really felt organized to the engineer in me. There were several other reports like places, events, and kinship reports that were interesting to view as well. I can see how this can get addictive because you find yourself thinking, hey, when was Aunt Edna born anyway? I need that data. As much fun as Mac Family Tree is to enter data and play around in views and reports, it seems that being able to show other people your family tree is really important. So let's talk about export options. There are 5 ways to export your tree. Website to hard disk, website to macfamilytree.com, website to MobileMe, website to CD/DVD, and Mobile Family Tree. I first exported the data to a website sitting on my hard drive, chose a few options like what kind of theme to use, and in just a few seconds, I had the website to view. It's really fun to navigate. You can look at your families, click on one of them, and boom, you're looking at the tree view along with a bunch of stats about the family. Really fun. Now, I didn't feel I had the right to show my own family tree online, you know, how some of the men are sensitive about having their age shown. But luckily, there's a lot of people sharing their online trees over at macfamilytree.com. All you have to do is filter on public only, and you'll be able to see how this thing looks. I did try to create a bit of the All My Children family tree, and I'm afraid I couldn't figure out how to create the complex relationships that exist in the soap opera. I was struggling trying to figure out how to enter the data correctly to make Mark Dalton, Erica's half-brother on Mona's side, while Silver Kane was a half-sister over on her father Eric Kane's side of the family. Now, while Mac Family Tree does support half-siblings, I couldn't figure out quite how to identify that subtlety. Creating stepchildren is really hard. You have to make sure that the child's birth date is before the new spouse's marriage date for that relationship to exist. Hopefully you only have one or two of these complexities in your background and you don't live the life of Erica Kane. Bottom line, Mac Family Tree is really, really enjoyable. Trivially easy to learn, easy to enter data about your family. It's beautiful to look at. The animations are pleasing and never overdone. As hard as I tried, the only thing I could find to complain about was that disappearing act on screen when you delete a person and making it a little, they could make it easier to edit a person. The developers over at CiniumSoftware.com have done a great job of creating a gorgeous piece of software, and believe it or not, Mac Family Tree is only $24.50. I would absolutely buy this for the fun I've had with it so far. So you know how I love to have a visit from Honda Bob, how much fun we have when he's crammed under the car with grease up to his elbows and Steve is out there giving Bob, you know, helpful advice. I love chatting with him about his latest gadget, like the time he got his hat camera or the USB pen with a camera in it. I think secretly he wanted one of those little spy cameras when he was a kid, and he's living vicariously through that. Or, you know, what has he done with the iPad he supposedly bought for his wife? You know, I remember when Justin and David were first visiting here, the first thing they said was, can we meet Honda Bob? And they actually got to meet him. Anyway, the downside of having Honda Bob work on your cars is that they run really, really well, and they don't need repairs very often. Steve and I were trying to think of a story I could tell for the ad this week, and we realized we hadn't seen Bob in so long and no story to tell. I guess that's the good news, but still. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. Well, yet again, U.S. CERT has nothing to report from a critical update perspective, but we do have some fun to report for those on Android. I'm going to back up, though, and lay the groundwork to keep panic at bay. Remember a while back there was a Trojan horse for the Mac that you could only get by going to a software piracy site and downloading an illegal copy of the iWork suite? And those of us who don't pirate sat back with our smug little faces and said, hey, you bad people, you deserve whatever you get. Well, essentially the same thing has happened on Android in China. Some bad guys have written a Trojan horse called, well, it's going to be hard to pronounce, Jinimi. It's G-E-I-N-I-M-I, which they're inserting into pirated copies of software for the Android platform. The Trojan horse is pretty nasty. It collects and sends info on the location of the device, uploads contact info to a remote server. It calls and sends SMS messages to phone numbers that'll cost you a fortune. Isn't that lovely? I asked Bart what I should tell you to do about it, and he advised sticking to the Android marketplace. But of course, that's not a curated store like the Apple, you know, curated, controlled, restricted access they have on theirs. So now you're in, say, a slightly bad neighborhood, but it's not gang infested. The next step is to check that all software you download, make sure it's got a lot of downloads and favorable reviews. If you do that, you're going to probably be okay. And I do emphasize the word probably. If you are unfortunate enough to get the Trojan horse, both Kaspersky and Symantec have fixes for it, and I put links in the show notes. Well, it's that time of the week again. It is chit-chat across the pond, but not with Bart Bouchotts just yet. But this week we have a special guest star, David Bogdan, who is a professor at a university in Japan. And David and I have been chatting for ages through email, and he's told me all these stories of these cool things he does in his class using technology. And I kind of wanted to get him on the show to tell us all about those things. Let's see. It's good evening, David. How are you today?
Doing just fine. It's actually morning here of the 31st.
Yeah, this is so bizarre. So it's not quite New Year's. It's New Year's Eve for you, but it's 5 in the afternoon for me.
Yes. So yes, it's the morning here on the 31st. So just got a little ways left.
So you're actually from the United States, but you teach in Japan.
Yes, that's true.
That's so confusing. I do want to get into that, but first I want to tell the people how you and I got connected. It was because you actually remembered.
Yeah, I started listening to podcasts about 3 or 4 years back, and mainly looked for stuff about Mac. And I started listening to the Mac Review Cast, and then I heard Allison on there, and I was so impressed right away. I got subscribed to the Nocilla Cast.
Yay!
Yay. And then a while after that, I heard you and Bart talking about the pronunciation of Nikon.
I think he calls it Nikon.
Maybe. And you were kind of going at it. And I heard it pronounced Nikon here or Nikon here. And so I asked my wife, who's Japanese. I said, yeah, is it Nikon? And she said, yes. So then I wrote that back to you. And I also, while I wrote back to you, I asked you about Bart's pronunciation of HTML.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things I enjoy about the show is getting to learn all these different – the pronunciation thing was hilarious. We got in a big argument in chat about HTML and HTML because I was talking about – let's see. He had said a HTML link, and I said it's an HTML link. And we were both right, because if you pronounce the hard H the way I do, it would be an. And if you pronounce it as a soft H like he does, it's the other way around. I don't know. That sounds really boring when I describe it, but I'm fascinated by it.
Well, I was reminded of Eliza Doolittle, My Fair Lady. I'm like, okay.
I love
but
it.
Then we got started on different things and computer languages and stuff. And it turns out that I know he loves Java, which I don't know, but Perl and JavaScript are two languages he really enjoys, and we were kind of going at it on that because I like those languages a lot. I'm not a programmer, but I've used them.
Okay. Okay, so getting on to the actual point of why I wanted you on the call, I'm intrigued because you're from the U.S., but you teach in Japan. Now, how on earth does something like that end up happening?
It's kind of a long, involved path, but come next April 1st, auspicious day, it'll be exactly 25 years to the day since I first arrived here in Japan.
Wow.
Yeah, my dad always found that date funny because he had landed on Okinawa on that date a few decades before.
Yeah, that's kind of ironic.
Yeah, April Fool's Day meant something to us both. But as to how I came here, I was in the U.S. and I'd just come back from spending a year-long Fulbright grant in Poland and was starting on my PhD. And I received a call one night from a buddy who I had gotten to know during one of my previous stays in Poland. He was an American.
Oh, okay.
But he was teaching at an all-girls junior college in Japan and was wondering if I'd be interested in teaching English there on a two-year contract. Now, English wasn't my field, but the words all girls, I was single in my 20s. Yeah, I was single in my 20s. Japanese.
That's all it took.
Yeah, that was right there.
But he had you at all girls, right?
My wife. Okay, anyway. I'd taken a bit of Japanese prior to that. And the other word, pay, I mean, my total gained employment as an adult had consisted of two brief stints teaching. One time I was a math science substitute in Northern California, and then another for a semester as a regular math teacher in Florida. So when I heard all three of those things, that kind of drowned out any notes of hesitation I might have had. And I said yes right there during the phone call.
Wow, that's crazy. I can't imagine. I mean, I've lived in the same place for, I don't know, 35, 40 years, I think. I guess you've lived in the same place for 25 now.
Yeah, this is the longest I've lived anywhere because I moved around in the U.S. a good bit.
Oh, it sounds like
it. And then the 3 years in Poland were all, you know, they were different times too.
So you had studied Japan and Japanese in college?
Yeah. When you're a grad student in linguistics, they ask you to take this, we called it a funny language requirement. You have to take two semesters of a non-Indo-European language.
Hmm.
You know, I had Polish and I'd taken Russian and stuff, so they didn't count. But when I ran into that requirement, I had just read the novel Shogun. I don't know if you know. But, yeah.
Oh, man, we were all running around saying, "Domo arigato," right after that. I mean, I still remember doing that.
Well, and I said, what the heck? I might as well try that. I mean, had I been reading Taipan at the time, I might be in China at the moment. It's kind of interesting the way things work out.
Wow. So are you in a huge city or a small village or I don't know anything about Japan?
Well, let's see. I came directly to a small town of 450,000. It's located on the smallest of the four main islands in Japan. It's called Shikoku, the island. If you were to look at the map, it's kind of in the southwest part. It's where I am is across the inland sea from Hiroshima, which I'm sure you've heard.
Yeah.
I mean, the population, 450,000, sounds like it's a big city, but it's pretty rural. A lot of citrus and, of course, rice. And that suits me fine because I originally came from a rural part of Ohio. You know, all you do is substitute corn for rice and citrus, and you know where I'm from.
How many people on earth have moved from Ohio to Japan, though? Like three, probably.
I haven't checked, but I know Honda had opened up a plant in Marysville, Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd heard they put up a big billboard there. Do you know how to say good morning in Japanese?
No.
Ohio gozaimasu, or Ohio.
Oh.
And I heard they had a sign that said, Ohio, Ohio. No one understood it, so I guess they didn't.
Nobody got the joke.
No one figured it out. That's what I heard. It could be an urban legend.
I like it. I like it. So you ended up at a private university there, you told me earlier, I think, and then you're at a more national university?
Yeah, I did my 2 years at the all-girls junior college, and actually extended for another year, but halfway through there was a permanent position at a private university in town, and so I applied for that and got a job there and was working there for 17 years. And then 5 years ago, for some reason, I'm trying to figure it out now, I decided to move to this university. I'd been teaching here part-time, including a computer class that I liked, and I kind of wanted to continue that.
Okay. Now, this is totally off script here, but I got to ask you, did you end up meeting your wife at the all-girls university?
That's what a lot of people ask, and no. It was actually through cycling, of all things.
Oh, okay.
I do a lot of cycling, so yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, people always tend to suspect
that.
Yes. But no. She was not a fan of English, actually, when we met.
Oh, interesting. Well, so I wanted to get the background because it was interesting to me how you ended up there. But a lot of times when we're chatting, you'll just drop these really interesting things you do about using technology. So can you walk us through some of the stuff that you do?
Well, I may stumble a bit, but I'll try. Well, I have two computer-related classes now, they one each term. And I teach this to students from the Education for International Understanding course in the College of Education here.
So is this an English-spoken class, or is it Japanese, or both? Or
typically Japanese. I'm not going to try to explain a lot of stuff in English and have to go through that. I know the terms in Japanese, and the menus are all in Japanese.
Wow. Okay.
So I pretty much go through that. I can also flip into English quickly if I want to for me to make it a little faster. But yeah, there a lot of it's in Japanese. So it's not a language class. But they do – some of the stuff they do is related to English.
Okay. But it's international understanding.
Yes.
What an interesting field. Okay.
So Education for International Understanding is the name of the course.
Okay.
Yeah. The new names of the class, I'm finally getting them to change it, is ICT – which is information and communication technology, and international or intercultural communication. And then I just named them one and two.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
So
what do you teach in those?
Well, the first class, it's the one I'm doing right now. I start the students on some raw HTML editing, and then some very basic JavaScript. So at the beginning, they make individual web pages in both English and Japanese, and we go through different things. And I do a little bit of CSS, but I'm not that fluent in it, and I don't want to confuse them any more than I have to. And then the remainder of the class, they form groups, and they're supposed to make interactive teaching materials using the JavaScript to make, like, quizzes.
Neat.
Yeah. I let them choose the topics. I don't know. Oh, did I interrupt?
No. I was thinking about. I wanted to back you up. And your purpose is not to turn them into web developers necessarily.
No.
It's more to give them the basic understanding of how the tools work, and then show them how they can use these towards these culturally related problems they're trying to work.
But you've got it right there.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. These kids are, they're not into the technology so much. That's not what they chose this field for. So, this is not a required class for them. Neither of them is required. And so I have to make sure they enjoy it.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to be stereotypical here. Are the kids really polite?
Or
are they just normal kids?
Well, I haven't taught in the U.S. in quite a while. So,
oh, okay.
I mean, I taught that high school math, and then I was a TA at the University of Florida for a while.
Hard to say.
Yeah, I'd say they are more polite, but things have changed in the 25 years, too. And I think I was explaining to you in the pre-show thing that, sensei, is that term known, for teacher? You maybe hear it in karate and things like that.
Yeah, okay, that's where I've heard it.
Yeah, Smith sensei or something like that. They often skip the sensei part, just yell my last name at me, which is kind of interesting. And the other teacher's going, what's going on here? I try to explain that if it were the first name, that might be a little more acceptable. But yeah, they're good, though. Basically, they're quite good.
Okay, cool. Well, and they did choose to take your class. They weren't forced into it, so that kind of helps. You get more engagement, I think, that way?
Yes, it was a required class up until 2 years ago, and then like the year after that it dropped a bit, and then it's come back a bit. So I'm fairly happy. It's not a large group of students anyway. We only have 21 max in the room.
Mm, okay. They're trying to introduce some aspect of Japanese culture into non-Japanese or the reverse. So how do they do that?
Well, they can make a reading. I have a reading thing, and I let them do the marquee thing, which can drive people crazy, but it's kind of a rolling marquee and time it. Okay. So make it a timed reading thing. They could do it in Japanese or that type of thing if they're doing it in that direction to teach the Japanese culture part. Or they can do it in English, something in English, and have the Japanese people try to figure out the English, and then they'll quiz them on that with the JavaScript.
Oh, okay.
Make multiple choice or fill in the blank questions.
All right.
I just want to give them an idea that they can do this.
Just to have them understand that these tools are there.
Yes.
Okay.
And they can also do audio or video. In the second class, we do more of the iLife type things. But in this class, I'll show them how to use Photo Booth and a little bit of, GarageBand. So if they just want to record something quickly or if they want to do a quick video.
Well, that's kind of nice because then they can get another toe in the water of what can be done, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. We do some playing around at the beginning of the class of what things are available.
Okay, cool. So let's see.
I also had they do language stuff occasionally too. I don't.
Oh, like what?
Well, often it's English or Japanese, depending on which direction they're trying to teach. Just ask questions about that. But I had one girl who was heading to China for a year exchange, and she made a quiz of Chinese greetings. She got one of the Chinese native speakers to give the greetings, record them on GarageBand, and then ask questions about that. I give them pretty much free rein.
I bet they really enjoy this. It sounds fun. I'd love to take this class.
Well, we'll connect you via Skype sometime.
There you go. I'll teach them podcasting.
That would be fantastic.
Except I'd have to do it at, 2 in the morning my time? No, midnight or something. Who knows?
Well, no, actually not so bad. The West Coast is a lot better than East Coast. I've got a lot of family on the East Coast in Florida, and that's a little rougher.
Oh, that's right. That's right, because it would be, you only have a couple hours of awake time at the same time.
Yeah, it's right now it's 14 hours, and then it goes to 13 hours, so it's directly opposite.
Oh, okay. That's gruesome.
With you and my brother, who's up in San Francisco, it's a little easier to find time.
Okay, good. So let's see. Now, you mentioned this is on the Mac.
Yes.
And how did that happen? I mean, I'm always assuming bigotry against Macs, I guess. But
how did I get on the Mac?
How did the classroom end up on the Mac?
Well, because of me, essentially. I like Macs.
Okay.
I made the switch from MS-DOS years and years ago. And so I enjoy the Macs. And there's a couple other teachers who have supported me. Actually, a number of the people in the group do use Macs. The English teachers tend to go with Macs a lot.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, did the students just jump right into that or?
Into using the Macs?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I used to get students kind of worried about they'd have to learn a whole new system and things like that. But usually about a week or two into the class or the second or third class, I keep hearing them talk to each other. Oh, but now I want a Mac. This is great. I go, okay. I'm not getting a commission, but it's kind of nice to hear that.
Oh, yeah, spreading the word.
I mean, doing the HTML, you don't need a Mac. It could be done, on a Windows machine or
Linux or anything, right?
Anything. I was saying you could probably do it on an email program. I used to do it on a Unix, on the Pico program, which is part of the Pine Mail program.
Oh, right.
You could do some of that stuff. So it's just text. And, of course, a browser can be used on pretty much any system.
Sure. Okay, I know what I wanted to ask you. So are iPhones and iPads and all that prevalent there or not?
Some of the professors have gotten iPads recently, I've noticed, mm-hmm. and brought them into the faculty meetings. I don't have one. I'm kind of jealous. But iPhones, I was just asking some students last week, and they said, yeah, everyone's getting iPhones now. It's pretty popular.
Okay.
But I don't think it, at the beginning, it was quite as popular. They were saying that.
Well, I don't know that it was in Japan until fairly late.
It took a while. And yeah. Then I don't, you know, what the Japanese were doing on their phones is something different from the iPhone. But I guess from what I understand now, there are a lot of people using them, and I'm seeing them a lot more.
So you don't have an iPhone yourself?
I don't have any cell phone myself.
You don't have a cell phone?
I do not have a cell phone. I have a, what do you want to call it, a spare cell phone. My wife and daughter have cell phones. And I got the spare one for kind of emergency. I do a lot of cycling, and just in case something happens, I want it with me. Or if I'm out in the woods mowing and stuff, mowing the weeds, in case something happens there, I'll keep the phone with me. But I
no cell. So I've got this high tech professor on a podcast, and you don't use a cell phone.
No, it's a little bit. I get ribbed about it occasionally.
I guess. Well, it'll be interesting to hear if you ever end up with an iPad. That would be fun.
I think I will. Right now I'm really looking at that, or this new MacBook Air looks really neat.
Oh, yeah. As I've been known to say, I think my husband loves his MacBook Air just a teeny bit more than he loves me. Oh. He just looks over at me. Very often he'll just go, I love my MacBook Air.
Is this one of the newer ones? Or
yeah, he had the original and then switched up to the bigger of the MacBook Airs with the bigger hard drive and more RAM and all that.
But it's a larger screen too, or
yeah, it's a 13-inch. He had a 13-inch before, but it was that thing was slow. It was pretty rough, but the new one's pretty fast.
Yeah, my sister bought one of those, and she took it with her on her deployment for a year. And I guess she liked it a lot, but I think it was slow in some respects.
Yeah.
But the new ones are pretty fast, I guess, with the new do you call them drives? Or?
Well, they're called solid-state drives. So, yeah, they're wicked fast, wicked fast, really, really fast.
Okay,
fun, so.
You about sold me here. You've sold me on a few things.
I don't know of anybody who has gotten one and isn't in love with it, that's for sure. And people who bought the original MacBook Airs and sold them off, both David Sparks and David did keep his. Don McAllister sold his off, and then he bought this one and just is in love with it.
Okay.
It's surprisingly powerful for such a little teeny thing.
Yeah, I've heard some people say, I mean, the fact that it is solid state, it makes a huge difference on some of the startup time and everything.
Oh, yeah. Boot up time is, God, what was it, 12 or 14 seconds?
Oh, okay.
That's crazy.
Okay.
Were you about to accuse me of spending a lot of your money? I started to hear that sentence I hear so often.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've got the Zoom H2 here. I want it for my students if they want to do interviews.
Oh, right, right, right.
I just had a student do an interview with an American. She's doing a paper on afterlife and Buddhism, and she talked to this American friend of mine about it, and she took my little Zoom with her, and it worked great.
Oh, fantastic. So, all right. Well, at least it's working. Now, I interrupted you before you got into your second class.
Okay. Yeah, I do have a second class. I forgot about that. This is a little bit different. It's how can I put it? Well, the ultimate goal is to make a DVD or make a video that'll go on a DVD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know Steve has said that DVDs are a thing of the past, but I need the portability.
I still don't. I don't understand his perspective on that. I got Steve Sheridan, a Blu-ray burner, and Roxio Toast, and we just saw his first Blu-ray burn DVD today. It took 20 hours to burn that thing, or to encode and burn it.
Oh, okay. I've never dealt with Blu-ray.
And that's where Donald Burr made us spend a lot of money.
Okay. Oh, okay. I have trouble with DVD because of this region thing.
Mm.
It's really a house because Japan's in a different region.
Oh, right, right, right.
From the U.S. And it seems kind of ridiculous that I have to buy two machines. You know,
but
just
you do.
Depending on which DVD I want to watch, where it comes from.
The anti-piracy stuff never hurts the pirates, only the people just trying to do normal things.
Yeah, it makes you want to copy stuff into a Region Free DVD, but I'm not so sure you're able to do that or not. Well, in any case, they're supposed to they form groups, and they're supposed to present intercultural material on these video shorts, usually about 10 minutes long. And we use the iLife suite quite a lot in the class, and also Keynote to put little quizzes and stuff and other effects in between the video shots.
Oh, okay.
So you export to video.
And do they like that? Do they have fun with that?
Yeah, they do some great things. Another piece of software, which you might have heard of is iStopMotion.
That's the first time I remember you saying you were using iStopMotion with the kids. That's the tool, for anybody who didn't catch the review, of that allows you to do stop-motion photography, like, you know, with little models and things. So what kind of stuff have they done with that?
Well, okay, well, let's go back to... I got this through a bundle. It was one of these big bundles about 3 years ago. And it's like buy two, get one free. So I have three licenses for an older version of it. And I put two on two of the Macs in the Mac lab and one I have in my office. So the students have been using it about 2 or 3 years now. One group did a little video on types of Japanese kimonos. There are a bunch of types, and you're supposed to wear them on different occasions. And what they did is they videoed one of the girls wearing the different kimono types. They provided subtitles in both Japanese and English, and narrative in English, explaining the type and when it is worn. And they put on some other effects, too, and then they made a video of it.
Oh, really? So they were just dressing in these kimonos or holding them up, or what were they doing?
They were dressing. They got a kimono shop to let them do this, kind of as a try on the thing, and they were outside in front of a shrine here close to the university.
Wow.
So, I mean, the sound on the video was all with cars going by.
That is a
tricky bit. I guess you call that post or something.
But, yeah, fix it in post, right?
But anyway, the intro and outro were done with iStopMotion.
Oh.
Yes, with boinks.com, if you need to know that. But they had little paper figures that they had moving across the paper. They're dragging sheets of paper explaining the origin and meaning of the word kimono. And had them drag it and say, yeah, ki means this and mono means this. And then at the end, they had the little figure waving a nice little cute farewell to the viewer.
Oh, how cute. That sounds fantastic.
And they did this on their own. I showed them how to do it. We did some play things in school, like having or play things in the class, like having desks move by themselves and things like that. But they came up with this. And I ended up using this video a couple times.
Oh, really?
Outside of class. One time I was on a trip. We were starting up an exchange program in the Philippines. This is 2 or 3 years back. And I had the DVD with me, and the other professors with me said, yes, you should show this to them. It was a class of Philippine students studying Japanese.
Oh,
so I showed it to them, and they really liked it. And then a year or so ago, I did the same thing in Thailand, same type of thing. And they enjoyed that a lot.
Oh, that's really cool. And now, one thing you told me, you had written to me, and that's what made me think of talking to you here finally, was that with iStopMotion, apparently, and I had not discovered this on my own, you can actually use voice recognition to tell it to take the pictures so you don't have to keep going back over to the computer and hit and click and that sort of thing?
Yes, yes. There are certain commands. You can have it, like, take one shot, two shots, three shots, four shots, and by just calling it out.
And,
now,
and does
it seems
that work?
It seems to work a lot better for me than for my Japanese students when they try it in English, but it does work.
Interesting. Now, that's part of the voice recognition of OS X. That's not a specific thing that that the Boinks people did.
Well, it's in their menus, and I mean, it's tailored to those commands that are going to only be used in iStopMotion.
Okay.
So I mean, they're probably using the basic speech recognition software there, but they've tailored it to their needs or to our needs.
So it sounds a little bit like maybe the students get do cooler things than you know how to do.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really find neat about the class is that every year the students come up with something that I don't know anything about. They surpass me. That's admittedly not a difficult thing to do by finding new HTML or JavaScript techniques or new ways to use this the iLife or the Keynote or even the iStopMotion software. And I have no problems about the teacher learning from the students. You know, in fact, for me, that should be the goal of education. When you raise the level of the student knowledge and interest to where they can go beyond you, I think you're doing a good job.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. It doesn't really make sense to only teach them up to a certain level that's not as much as you know. I mean, to have them surpass you, that's just like, that is very cool.
Well, the word sensei for teacher in Japanese kind of means having lived ahead or in time or something like that. It doesn't mean God or anything like that.
Or smarter.
Well, just having experienced it beforehand.
Oh.
And you know, that doesn't mean that they can't go beyond what you've done. And they do.
Okay. So it sounds like you're using some fairly basic tools within the OSIN suite, but giving them all these nice bits and pieces of what they can do, right?
Yeah, the only paid thing would be the iStopMotion, essentially, of software, because I'm using iLife. And there's a free paint thing that I've put on there. And, of course, the video camera and stuff like that cost a bit, and someone's recommended H2. it's mainly just on the Mac, and the students really like that it's all right there.
Cool. Now, a couple of years ago, I like to go to the Scale Conference, the Southern California Linux Expo, and the first year I went, the Friday session turned out to just have a couple of tracks, and one of them, they have a lot more tracks nowadays, but one of the tracks was an education track, so I ended up going through that, and I heard about a product called Moodle, and you told me you used Moodle in your classes.
Wow, funny you should bring that up. Yeah, I started using it here about 2-3 years ago. The university had been using something called Blackboard, which was a very expensive paid system. But,
so what is Moodle? What does it do?
Yeah, it's not this. They call it a CMS, a course management system. That's usually for the education thing, or it could be an LMS, learning management system. Like you can make little tutorial type things and have people work through that. But what I know, it was developed by an Australian grad student for his PhD. That's what he came up with, this Moodle system.
What do you do with it? Oh, and it's open source, by the way, which is why it was at the Scale Conference.
Yes, it is open. I started off, originally, I used to use email a lot to distribute assignments and get the students to send it back, and it got kind of hairy. But that's what I started with this, because it's a one common site where they can put it in. There's easy ways to get it and easy ways for them to read it, you know, from anywhere without going through email.
So it's a website, a web-based application?
Yes, it is web-based, and they have a HTML editor included with the program or software. But I've gradually, there's all sorts of things you can do with it, and I'm only hitting the tip of the iceberg. I've started to put in feedback, have questionnaires. I'll put in video materials because I'll have the kids do skits and put the skits on the thing and have the other kids look at them and evaluate and have the students evaluate their own skits. And I've started very recently is interactive forums. I don't know if that means...
Yeah, no, that's very cool. So they can ask each other questions.
Yes, I'll put up questions from a reading, or recently I did a regular movie that I had them watch, and I put up some questions, and I said, you can comment, ask questions, and you should make sure you look at the other people's posts and reply to them, ask questions of me, and I will answer. So I'm taking part in it, too.
Are they getting into that?
Well, it's a lot better than you asked what Japanese students are like. One of the major problems is that they often will not respond. They'll keep quiet. You know, ask, does anybody have any questions? And you're just sitting there with nothing. And a lot of the students don't want to be the first to talk. I forget there is an expression in Japanese, and I won't do the Japanese part. It's like, but the nail that sticks up gets pounded in.
Oh, I've definitely heard that. For a boss of mine worked for or lived in Vietnam, was born in Vietnam, and he said that is a real common phrase, that you definitely, you don't speak up, you don't ask questions, you don't talk.
And for us, it's a squeaky wheel that gets the grease. So.
Right, right. I could never survive there. How do you say it in Japanese?
No, don't have me do it in Japanese.
Why? Come on.
Myself.
I get nothing? I get no Japanese out of you?
I'll give you a Happy New Year at the end.
All right.
Because that'll be a little more. But anyway, I think they find it easier just to do these quick one-liners.
Right.
I'll let them, if they want, they throw in Japanese, too, if they have a hard time expressing, and I'll try to explain that you could say it this way in English. And it's also better than if they do an essay type thing. They get a little paranoid about that. So I think it works out pretty well. One of the classes we did, the first class, we actually took them to a computer room and gave them easy topic and said, just put something down, and I'll put something down, and it got them started on it. So
they saw how easy it was.
Yes.
So you can actually distribute the assignments that way? They can download them from the Moodle site you've created?
Yeah, they can download assignments. This is just a forum, and I just give them the link to it, and I have the questions on it, and they can do that. It has a wiki. So I'm having the students in this ICT class. I have three groups right now, and they're working collaboratively on their projects, so I just let them use the Moodle. The thing about the Moodle is only one person can edit it one time.
Oh, okay.
On the wiki, I'm sorry.
Oh, the wiki. Only one person can edit. Yeah, well, that...
Well, because it's the same. It's one document.
Yeah, that's fairly common. There are some that you can do some editing at the same time. There's a really cool thing. It was invented. It's called Etherpad. And Etherpad ended up going open source. They got bought by Google. And they ended up going open source, and there's a couple of them have been created. You might want to check out piratepad.net. It's essentially a web page that everybody can edit at the same time. And it's a pure text editor. I mean, there's nothing tricky. You can't put in graphics or anything like that. It's kind of confusing. If you go to piratepad.net, you're going to be looking at this weird frog and not be able to tell what to do. Okay. I forget what language it's in, but it's not in English. But if you go to piratepad.net/ and type anything you want, it'll create a pad with that name, and then you can simply start editing.
Oh, okay. Well, unfortunately, Moodle doesn't have this.
But you could create these pads and link to them and have people have the kids work on them at the same time.
That's good. But the one thing that the Moodle thing is nice is that password protected. It's on university server, and we have to be really careful about materials from the students getting out.
Right.
So
you can actually install Etherpad on your internal network.
Okay, that might be an idea.
And it's open source. It's free, but that'll be at a later class.
Yeah, I'm going at snail pace right now.
Well, I don't know. This sounds pretty cool.
Editor I have problems with is, I mean, I like Safari. That's my favorite browser. I know you have various opinions on the various browsers, but Safari's nice.
I'm just fickle. I go through my Safari moods. Right now I'm in a Chrome mood. As soon as Firefox 4 comes out, I'll be back on that.
Well, I use Firefox with the Moodle.
Oh.
Because the students are going to be able to use Firefox much more easily. I know there is Safari on Windows. You and I had a discussion about the way they force it on people.
But
I'm not. None of the students seem to know about it. So use Firefox, and one of the reasons is because the students will know that format.
Sure,
I think
that's easier.
And then the other thing is this HTML editor they're using does not play nicely with Safari. Hmm. It just shows the whole source instead of the nice little WYSIWYG.
I was
worried about HTML editors, but the one we use for the show notes does it fine with Safari. So I hope they will change that at some point.
Yeah, the one he's talking about to the audience here is called pbworks.com. And it's a free wiki thing, and this is where I've always done the show notes, and everybody seems to be able to use it pretty well.
I'm really impressed with it.
And it's got good access controls. You know, I can make people authors, but not editors, or authors, but not administrators. So, you know, David, he'll just go in there and go crazy and mess everything up. You know,
this is another David we're talking about.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, but in any case, I've still got more to do with Moodle as time goes on.
Can it do?
Oh, I mean, you can do module learning, independent learning. I mean, my goal is I want to reduce the seat time in the classroom of the students. I don't know if the powers that be will allow that, but they're putting a lot of – the students are doing a lot when they're doing this back and forth on the forum.
Oh, okay.
And that's in addition to homework and to reading and stuff, and I'd like that counting. It's to me, it's more effective than having them sit silently in the classroom, having me try to drag out answers from them.
Oh, right, right.
And there is blended learning. I've got a friend who teaches math in the U.S. is doing a lot, not through Moodle, through something else, but I guess that's a way to do it, especially when you're handling large numbers of people. And this would give me a chance to, if I ever take off for a while, maybe get back to the U.S. for a visit or something that I could maybe
you could
do
still
it.
Interact. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And Skype and that. And, it would be really beneficial.
That would be interesting to be able to do the class via Skype sometime.
I've in a couple of my classes, these computer classes, I've done Skype things. I have a friend in New Zealand teaching at a university there, and his wife is also teaching there. She's teaching Japanese, so we had the Japanese learners and my kids talking. Had my brother, who's kind of in the tech industry there in California, talk with the class about kind of cultural things and business.
Oh, interesting. So you actually had the two classes talking to each other?
Well, there were only three or four people. And then, I had it up on the big screen so everyone could see. And I did this with my kids, two of my kids in elementary school. When they were sixth graders, they wanted to set some type of international thing up. So I had my family in Florida stay up until about seven or so and get on the big screen. And my kids' classmates were supposed to ask questions and get answers and do different things. My sister had her uniform on, and she had also sent us an old uniform, so the kids were able to put that on and try it on while she was talking to them. So that was kind of neat. They really enjoyed
wow.
that.
Oh, yeah, that does sound cool. Well,
so,
David,
yeah, Skype is useful.
It sounds like you've done some really creative stuff, and you're learning every day from your students. I knew this would be fun talking to you.
Well, I've enjoyed listening to your podcast. I learn a lot every time from you, too.
Maybe you could play this for the students.
Yeah, they'll. Gosh, she can speak English.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. What did he say? All right. Well, I'm going to have you. Let's see. I had asked you before the show if there was a way people could get a hold of you, but we decided the best way, if someone wanted to write to David, is if they wrote directly to me, and then I'll forward information to him, and then he can choose who to respond to. So if anybody wants to ask him any questions, give him suggestions or anything, shoot it on out to me.
I appreciate that. Did you want the Happy New Year? Or?
Yes, let's close it out with a Happy New Year.
Okay, there are two. Okay. It's not New Year's yet, so you have to wish someone the Happy New Year first before it happened. That's Yo-Yo Toshio.
Okay.
Do you want to try it?
Yo-Yo Toshio?
Something like that. That sounds good.
I missed a few syllables, didn't I? Do it
no,
again.
That's not right. Yo-Yo Toshio. And it's actually
Yo-Yo Toshio.
Yeah, probably people are going to laugh at my pronunciation. And then at the once it's New Year's, tomorrow I will be able to say, Akemashite omedetou gozaimasu.
Oh, I'm not trying that one.
And which that means the New Year has opened or dawned or whatever, and congratulations.
All right.
So yeah.
That's fantastic, David. I really appreciate you coming on and standing in for Bart, and appreciate you being here.
Those are big shoes to fill, and I don't think I did, but thank you very much, and hello to everybody.
Well, that's going to finally wind up the show for this week. I hope you learned something, maybe had a laugh or two, or at least you were entertained. If you'd like to join the live show sometime, be sure to head on over to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the Nocilla Castaways for a bit of fun. Until then, keep up the dumb questions, send in your audio recordings, or just say hi by writing to Allison@podfeet.com. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.